Scott. Texas God Radio Show, CBS. This is your host, Tom Edison. That's right. This is Connect the Dots, and we're going to rock and roll tonight because this is Rocktober. And let's just get right started. I'm going to be talking to Kathy C.C. Carlson of Gemstar Records. So let's just get down to it. Kathy, are you on the phone?
I definitely am, Tom, and I'm raring to go here. I love your show, Connect the Dots, and I love BBS Radio. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, hey, I'm all excited talking to you here. Tell us about, just give us some brief description of your Gemstar Records you have in southern New Mexico, right?
Yes, exactly. I live in Silver City, New Mexico. It's actually home of the birthplace of Billy. Well, it wasn't the birthplace, but he actually lived here, Billy the Kid. So there's a lot of outlaws and a lot of famous cavalry battles here, and I'm here loving it. The weather's gorgeous, and so I'm doing my music here. And as you know, Tom, I am agent to Liz Presley, and I'm also a president and CEO of Gemstar Records, which we are gearing towards music for global change, making the planet aware. And we also have, of course, you know, the various genres of music, and we have instrumentalists that we're looking into possibly either signing or using their music and syncing it for film and TV projects.
Tell me about you have obviously your recording studio there, right?
Well, quite honestly, I've recorded, you know, other places, and a lot of people I co-write with, which I hope some writers are listening, from the early days when I first started writing my first song in 1996, Do Roses Come in Blue, which I co-wrote, and it became the Song of the Year for the California Country Music Association, the first song I ever wrote. I've been working with people that... at first I worked with people in L.A., and then I worked with people in Nashville, and I worked with people in Muscle Shoals, and now Memphis, and, of course, still L.A. So, and then I'm looking to do more things here in New Mexico and connect with people here as well. So
you use different recording studios for different events. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and what it is I would advise a lot of songwriters and other people and artists even, they might not even think about it. But when I first started, I joined a lot of songwriting organizations. I joined the Nashville Songwriters Association International. They have locations all over the country, all over the world. They're the second not-for-profit songwriting organization, but their headquarters is in Nashville. But what I did is... people advised me, like, what are you going to do with songs? And I said, well, my mom is a book author. My brother is a cinematographer and book author. And now he's actually a best-selling, New York best-selling author as well, best-selling book author, and a movie award-winning cinematographer, et cetera. But collaborate. That is the best way to do it. Collaborate with people who... maybe have their own studios, collaborate if you're not a musician, collaborate with people who are musicians, all of those things. And then together, when you record things, songs, they're only like half the price. And then you might even find someone to songwrite with who is a producer who actually even has a home studio. And so I cut the cost a lot by doing that. So I think it's people should pay more attention to that. And what it is with the Internet now, you can do tracks and you can send them to one another. So somebody can do a vocal track and you don't even have to be in the same state or even in the same country. So,
yeah, I mean, philosophically speaking, co-creation is the way of the universe. And you're talking about co-creation there, you know? A lot of great projects come when people come together on something. And
Exactly.
That's a good path you're following, definitely.
Yeah, and no one can do it on their own time, you know. Everyone has to work with a team. Sooner or later, they'd have to work with a team, you know.
So. Yeah, I mean, especially in the music business, you know. I took it one time in my life. I took it as far as I could possibly go by myself, and then I realized, you know, without a distribution of everything I put together, you know, I formed a record label. I made five original recordings to start off with. I visited the major studios in New York, you know, to try to get a label to back me up. And I did distribution in all the jukeboxes and all the diners around New York City. And then I realized finally, you know, if I don't have a group backing me up to do distribution, I didn't even have a band together at the time, that this wasn't going to go any further than I took it. And I took it about as far as anybody could take it as one person.
That's very commendable, because it's not easy. And you need resilience and perseverance in the music industry, in the business. So that's great. And then you ended up branching out, right, Tom? A little bit into film and such?
Well, yeah. You know, I'm always doing something in my life. And then eventually I bought myself a camera and started doing video. I started filming bands and clubs. But this was like so far back, you know, the medium was still VHS. And then again, I took it as far as I could by myself, and I quickly realized that you can't do editing with VHS because it degrades the quality when you want to edit. Even though I put together a documentary or Advertisers Misguiding Women. I got it put on a cable network for a couple weeks. And again, I took it as far as I could by myself, and it wasn't far enough. And then I didn't have the money to buy. Back when VHS was the only format you could do as an independent person without spending a fortune on professional cameras, unfortunately, that was the problem with VHS. You know, you couldn't edit it because it would degrade.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a bunch of VHSs because back in 1996 through about 2000, I was on a TV show on Adelphia Cable, Bonavision Cable in L.A., and I was a co-host with David Fuentes. It was called The David Fuentes Show, and so I had a lot of great time with that, and, we had, you know, mainly, like, a large, you know, like, Hispanic audience, which was great, and I would go to the soccer games in the fields, and everyone would recognize me, and then we also had a great Asian presence, too, in that area. And I would go get my nails done or whatever. I'd get recognized there, too. But yeah, it went out to about 2.5 million people, you know, they had on that. But it was experience, because it gave me an ability to be able to interview and be interviewed. And it's lasted with me all this time, and it's really helped me, you know. So, and I volunteered, just like I volunteered for a lot of things.
Yeah,
it's not always paid.
I've done a lot of things for nothing, too. I mean, I can think back. The last band I was in was an all-original band, and it was like volunteering. You know, we play a gig when you're playing original music only. You end up, each member gets about $10 for the night.
I know. So you can't be in it for the money, can you? You got to be in it for the love of the music, for the camaraderie, for the creativity, and whatever else, the healing part of music, I believe. And
I guess I didn't think of it back then, but I guess I was born poor and learned to live on close to no money. And I've never never been unhappy. You know, I never needed a lot of money to be happy. And I was willing to try anything. And like I said, I've taken just about everything I ever did. I took it as far as I could by myself because I'm a very independent person. And mm-hmm. the only bands I was ever in was other people's bands. And but that wasn't satisfying enough for me because I wanted to be the rock and roll lead singer. And eventually I proved I could do it. You know, I was on cable shows. But the one thing I was lacking, which just makes it difficult when you're trying to try to get your original music out there, if you don't have a band that's out there playing, that's all and everything, basically.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I just interviewed a friend of mine, Stephen Foster, on the Gem Stars podcast that I do, you know, with Plastic EP of Australia, which I'd love to have you on the show sometime, Tom, as well, you know. And we'll talk about a good date, you know, to set up. But, I was just talking to Stephen, and he's an independent radio promoter and all kinds of things, and he'd been an independent artist for 50 years. And he finally, you know, has hit it big. I mean, he had opportunities. He even wrote with Leonard Skinner and all kinds of people, like 1969 when things are happening in Muscle Shoals. But you just gotta do what you can do, because even when you might even have an opportunity to write with a famous person, all kinds of things happen, and there's politics, and people don't always get paid anyway. He even said that he participated in some things and didn't get paid, you know, and wrote some things and never got paid and stuff. So it's just part of the deal. But, you know, it'd be great if everybody was fair. And that's why I work with Liz Presley as well on her music publishing coaching and her book publishing coaching. And I'm her agent because we help people collect the royalties on their publishing, you know, even if they don't have a necessarily publishing company themselves, but as an artist and a songwriter and all that, because it's really hard to track your royalties. And they're small, so small that it's worth it to track them right, because you can end up getting a lot more than you thought.
Believe me, I'm quite impressed with Liz Presley's 360 plan. As I was talking about on the show 2 weeks ago. And, you know, it's cutting a new path through the woods to be helpful to people that have talent and would like to make some money out of things.
But one of the things I was going to emphasize that Stephen even said, and I'd forgotten even about it because I got caught up in the conversation, was he said that you should always make friends with the radio DJs. At least in the old days, he used to be able to do that, you know, to the local places, and then they would get gigs. Then they would have also promote bands that would have, you know, and promoters that do gigs. And so you just got to network. That's all I mean. That's what I'm saying. You got to network. And you got to start off in a certain locale and then branch out. You just can't try to be an international artist from the start, you know. You got to get, you know, where people are noticing you, so.
Yeah, that's so true, so true. I mean, because I don't have a band, because I'm out there playing, you know, I got 25 videos out there on YouTube, but the world isn't really aware of that so much because, you know, there's a million other people out there with videos. I mean, the market flooded with videos, so... Without some backup, it's not going to go too far what I get out there. But the more I do them, the better I get at them. And, I'm pretty happy with the fact that I got 25 of them out there. And
yeah, that's quite a bit.
How many people say they got 25 rock and roll videos out there? I mean, really. And they're all original music.
That's accomplishment.
I heard you were a backup singer once, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was interesting. That was very interesting. A friend of mine was, she was having a showcase, and she said there's going to be like a little boat that leaves, like a little river cruise boat out of Marina Del Rey in California. And so she said, would you like to perform on it? And I said, okay. So my identical twin sister and I, we got dressed up, our velvet gowns or whatever, we sang a couple original songs, and we were told that if we did a good job, if there was somebody in the audience, and it turned out we ended up knowing them, that knew a singer who had a band, and they were going to Japan, and they were going to go with a concert association, so it was going to be a big deal. And my twin sister and I had performed the songs together. I'd perform mine solo in Los Angeles, you know, various showcases like the Songwriter Guild of America. We went to West Hollywood. We performed at Luna Park. You know, I used to do a Nashville Songwriter Association, you know, showcases once a month at Hollenbeck's in Hollywood, California. Actually, I was the event producer, and I found the location, and I worked with a couple other people that helped with the events and did the workshops, so all that. So that's kind of what happens. So, like, again, you're involved with all that. You're meeting all these people, and then people invite you to things. And from that opportunity, we got to go on tour. And we got to go on tour with a cover band that sang a lot of Elvis songs, which was great. And we were backup singers. We're like the Jordanaires.
Yeah. How many backup singers were there?
There were four altogether. My twin sister and I did more like the alto, and they did more like the soprano. And at first I thought they'd have us do the soprano because we're normally sopranos, but they switched it, which was okay because you have to be a quick learner, so you got to change your parts, and that was fine. And, I mean, who doesn't know all the Elvis songs? I mean, we watched all the movies since we were, you know, like we could watch TV, you know, from knee-high to grasshopper. We were watching all that, you know.
Elvis
and
movies.
So, you know, so we loved Elvis.
There.
We loved his music. And, you know, my family, my parents were professional dancers. And my dad was a singer. So, yeah, it just kind of used to end. And we just had a great time. And we toured all over the place. It was in 1997, just before the Winter Olympics in Japan. And they were preparing for that. So it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like you have a lot of experience in life. And
Let me ask you a question. We performed to like people 2,000 or more, you know, state of the art. I mean, the Japanese, when they do something, they do it right, you know. And they had a headquarters, the Minon International in Tokyo, where they had all these antique instruments like King Louis pianos and gold and all kinds of really gorgeous instrumentation and old, centuries old. And it was like the museum was about six floors or more. So, and then we loved it because we get driven around the taxis with the taxi drivers and the long white gloves, and we'd be traveling on those bullet trains. We never even knew what a bullet train was, but, man, they really know how to do it there in Japan. They were really state-of-the-art back in 1997. So.
Yeah. I'm aware of the bullet trains. They need some bullet trains in New York City, I think. The subway system, it's just, like, badly run. You know?
How fast do they go?
Not fast at all. I mean, this is it. When I was a child, the trains used to run fast, you know? Now they got them all regulated. They can't go beyond a certain speed. They have no pickup. And the system is a logjam, you know, at least half the week. and it's badly run, and the thrill of taking a train has been taken away from the people because they run them so slow now. I guess, you know, somebody's idea, well, we have to do it safely. But
But there weren't that many accidents.
They don't have
any fast trains
in New York City, not at all.
Yeah, so, okay. Oh, well, what can you do about that?
You drive a car. I mean, truthfully, car is way faster than the subway train, you know, if you know how to drive, what streets to drive on. And even that, they've just changed the, I know this has nothing to do with music, but the recent mayor of New York, total jerk, he lowered the speed limit from 30 miles an hour with a car down to 25. You know, people.
I don't want to slow down. Accidentally driven 20 miles an hour.
Yeah, I mean, right? You know, these politicians are so crazy. They're liable to lower to 20. You know,
and yeah.
So there's no fast transportation in Manhattan. The fastest thing going is if you get in your car, you just speed. That's it. Which everybody used to do a long time ago, but not anymore. Too many red lights now, too many traffic laws, and it's not what it used to be. And certainly no bullet trains. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, anyway, getting back to the music, you know, I mean, you know, how is everything doing there in New York? Is there bands performing out? What's going on there?
Well, in New York City itself, no, the place is stagnated with the COVID rules and everything like that. You can't even go in a restaurant now. I mean, things only got worse. You can't even go in a restaurant unless you have proof that you've been vaccinated. Is that crazy or what?
Yeah, well, are they still performing though? I mean, are they still bands performing in clubs and stuff like that? I know the shows, the theatrical show productions.
As far as I know, nobody's performing basically in New York because they got all these ridiculous rules.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, so there might be a few rare ones that perform.
Yeah, there might be some small bar that has a band playing or something like that, but.
Okay, I see what you're talking about. But yeah, see, since all this is still happening, and it probably is going to happen for a little while, and it's probably going to happen through the winter, you know what I mean? But so we're still going to be active musically, you know, we still got to create. And everybody knows the music industry and the film industry basically is closed down November 1st. It doesn't open again till January 1st. So I advise people, if they're going to have any song releases, that they should wait until at least February 1st, you know. It's not worth releasing any new songs right now, you know. You're not going to get the effect on the radio charts or streaming or downloads or anything because people are so occupied, you know, with the upcoming holidays still.
Here's a question I want to ask you. As president of Gemstar Records, what can someone expect when they contact you with a cold call and say, hey, I heard you on the radio, Gemstar Records. I want to make some recordings. How do you take it from there?
Okay, well, a lot of people want me to, they want to just discuss with me, am I interested in signing an individual label, artist or band? That's the first question. And then the second question they ask me is, would you be interested if they're a songwriter, of course, or even a musician, would you be interested in pitching my songs for film and TV? Those are the main things that people want. And then they ask me if I know a promoter or publicist a lot of times. Because, again, like you said, distribution is important, and it is important. But people got to realize, and artists got to realize when they first start out, when they're still learning, that it's not a distribution deal isn't going to happen that quickly, you know, because they got to start, you know, getting making their mark as an individual artist or band, and they have to keep their songs and their music consistent and not change their genres. They need to keep them, you know, similar. when they and it's better to come out with an EPK, which is usually about 4 or 5 songs, than it is an album now. And people should release songs individually as singles, because they get more attention until they get recognition. All those things is building your brand, building your brand. You got to do that, you know. It's so important. So people need to focus. And if they say they want to be like a country artist and they need to have songs that at least have sound a little bit like country, I mean, I know Nashville is changing and they have so many genres now, but you still need to sound a little bit country if you say you're going to do country. So you still need to sound a little bluesy if you say you're going to do blues. I mean, it just makes sense, you know. So you just got to, you got to zone in on it and, you know, test certain things and see if they work. And if they don't, then say something's not working, I got to change it, you know.
So what exactly is Gemstar Records going to do for these people that contact you? What do you tell them you're going to do for them?
Well, I tell them that if there's any interest in any movies, of course, I'm working with Liz Presley now, and I've been working with her on a film project. She's going to be doing her book is called Kid of the King, and she's going to be doing a documentary and a feature film. And so, you know, and you never know where opportunities for music can come up. But then at the same time, Liz is going to be writing songs. She does write. She's a songwriter. So we're going to be looking for people to collaborate, to write songs together, because, you know, that's important too. So, you know, those are the kind of things. And so I just tell people, just, you know, give me a little bit of time here because, you know, during this pandemic, sometimes you got to wait and see just what the trends are going to be and what's going to be happening and everything like that. But it's really, really important, again, to have a coach. And I fully recommend Liz Presley as a music publishing and a book publishing coach, because if you join these online companies that say they're going to promote your music, and you think you're going to be that they're going to be giving you a full portion of your royalties, you are totally wrong. They have it so tied up that by the time you get whatever, even if it sounds good at the beginning, you're only going to get a small percentage unless you do it right. Because some of like the CD babies and certain companies, they clash with each other. So you won't even get some of your royalties because they do this. So, again, if you want to go to LizPresley.me, that's where she discusses it. And if you want to contact me, I'm her agent, just agent at LizPresley.me. And I'll be happy to talk to you about it.
Do you have a basic phone number or contact info for Gemstar Records that you want to give out right now?
Well, you can just,
Google.
You can just do info at gemstarrecords.com or, you can do that. You can go to my website, gemstarrecords.com. And then I have a music publishing company with lots of songs that have been placed in film and TV. And I do that a lot with a lot of co-writers I've written that have had Grammys. They've been on the Billboard charts. And that's another thing I recommend to people, that they look for people who have experience, who have status. And then, your songs are worth more if you write with somebody who's had hits before and placements in film and TV. So, and that's Music to My Ears Publishing. And I've had that company since 1996. As soon as I became a songwriter, people advised me to open up a publishing company. And I think that's what people should do by choosing, either ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC,
So. Uh-huh. Well, that's very good info. Remember back to when I made my first recordings, I haven't copyrighted. I went to... back when you could walk in places, I think ASCAP was on 53rd Street. I just walked in there and I filled out the forms. And somehow I magically thought that they were going to send me money if I deserved any, you know, but it didn't happen because I didn't have any distribution and very little radio play, and that was it. Yeah, here, let me just tell you a funny story. When I made my first set of records, I didn't have a band, you know. I spent most of my life going out playing to have fun, you know, not bands. I spent not that much time in bands when I was a teenager. I was in sometimes two bands at the same time because nobody had bass players. And so I bought myself a bass guitar, and everybody wanted me in their band because bass players were hard to find. So anyhow, when I made my first records, this is back in the early 80s, first professional recordings, I just looked in a magazine to see if I can find two people to back me up. And it was a bass player and a drummer. So I called them up. I told them, you know, what I'm doing. Are you interested? You know, I'm going to be bringing the records over to Atlantic Records. And they said, yeah, fine. We want to be part of that. And went over to their house. Well, we showed up at their friend's studio. He only had a four-track machine. So we practiced there for about 2 hours. And then 2 days later, we came back. And within 2 to 3 hours, we put down 5 songs. You know, they were quick learners, and it just went that fast. You know, 1 or 2 takes on each song, and that was it. And it was done. So when we were done that night, at the end of the last song we recorded, we all decided to laugh, you know, an hysterical laugh. And that shows up in some of my videos out there on YouTube. And we said, are we going to hear this song on the radio tonight on the way home? That's how, you know, childish we were thinking.
But you know what? It's okay. Everybody's come from the same place, and everyone's had dreams and aspirations, and you just, you know, you get a bit of reality, and then the ones that really want to continue just continue. And so it sounds like that's what you did, and that's great.
Yeah. You know? I mean, we didn't take ourselves seriously, but it was kind of a joke. One of us said that, and we all laughed, you know.
As if that
were possible. You know, all we had was the quarter-inch tape out of a four-track machine. We're going to hear this on the radio on the way home tonight.
That's okay. That's okay. Now, Tom, we have some things in common, don't we? As far as, you know, like books and things like that, and you've written some stuff having to do with some, you know, paranormal subjects and things like that, right?
Yeah. Isn't that right? You have had, what, 2 books or 3?
Yeah, 2 books. The first book is called Beyond the Veil of Sedona, and it's a photographic journal book. And my twin sister and I actually wrote it, and we took photographs. And one of our photographs was the Sedona woodpecker shapeshifter photograph taken right in the backyard of my home that I lived in called Rivendell. I bought it. It was called Rivendell, which is the same as Lord of the Rings. And it was painted white with green trim, and everything was green. And it had a little cottage, and it was right near Oak Creek Canyon. And it had views of the mountains, and it was just near Grasshopper Point, in between Grasshopper Point, and there was another famous place there in Slide Rock State Park in Oak Creek Canyon, right just south side of Sedona. So it was a great experience, we took paranormal photographs. And how can you go wrong when you're in the vortices and the portals of Sedona? I mean, they had such Native American legend history that after we took the shapeshifter photograph where a woodpecker changed from a regular-looking woodpecker to like this like image of this, like I don't know. He had a red beret and a kind of a figure, unusual figure, like a shapeshifter kind of thing. And then we researched that there was the Yavapai Apache Native Americans in Boynton Canyon, which is not far from there at all. And their creation story was created there during the flood. And an Apache woman, Apache woman, was bathing in the water, and then a flood happened, and a woodpecker saved her life by showing her a log and all this. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is there's a lot of correlations between the Native Americans' beliefs and some of the things that we hear about, like the, you know, the fairies, the nature spirits and all of that, the orbs and the little people, and even the Cherokee believe in little people. And there's a lot of that energy in Georgia and near the Trail of Tears and all over, really. So so that was the first book. And then the second book was a takeoff of more about ghosts and more about orbs and not as much the light, airy, fairy, nature spirit kind of thing. And it just was about, we even took a picture of my dad, ghost. It was San Pedro. It was on the cliffs, and my daughter just had a baby, and it was the first grandchild on both sides. And we said we wished our dad was there because he had died in 1997 of, you know, cancer, leukemia. And then I took a picture of the family, and then I said I wish my dad was here right now. And my dad's face was transposed over my daughter's face, and it was as vivid as anything. It was him. So in my book, in our book, Beyond the Cloak of California, we show a picture of my dad before he passed, and then the way his spirit transposed his face over my daughter's, where she was sitting next to the baby in the stroller while we were on the cliff. So, you know, those kind of things. I mean, you know, it's very powerful. I mean, when you see these things in photographs, and it isn't like they just came out like one all of a sudden. You know, we have a lot more different ones, but it was like a journey. It's really a journey. So we really teach people where you can actually do this yourself. You could take pictures and you know, and then we share a lot of legends that actually back up some of these photographs in which they talk about shapeshifters and all kinds of things, you know, spirits and orbs and all that.
My question is, the picture of the shapeshifter, do you actually see, well, these are photographs, so it's not a video, right?
No, they're photographs, but what happened is, my sister took a picture of the woodpecker when he was just a regular old woodpecker. Then she decided to take a second photograph. And what happened was she felt like some kind of force, like forcing her camera down it, like in her hands. And she felt like she wasn't meant to take it. And it was like, it was hard, difficult for her to even take the second picture, but she did. And when she did, lo and behold, I mean, there is an entity, kind of looks like a small, like ape man kind of thing. Like he's got, and he's got a red beret. And when we were interviewed, because we used to do a lot of interviews, like in the early, you know, 2010, 20, you know, from 2012, around there, 2012.
Mayor of New York.
Someone had said they were Native American. And whenever there's a red beret kind of thing showing up, that's like a sign of war. But that's what he said. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. And we've got a lot of other cool photos that are out of this world, basically. And what we did in the beginning, we used digital cameras, and then now we just use regular iPhones and Android phones and digital phones, because they can actually pick up a lot that, you know, even digital cameras have difficulty. Because if you've ever watched any of those haunting shows on TV, you know, they even have problems with their equipment sometimes, because spirits and other entities can mess with it, you know. And so, but the cell phones, they don't seem to have that problem, you know.
Well, there's a lot about photography. Was this in the daytime or the nighttime?
Now, most of the pictures we took were during the day. I mean, there was a time when I took, like, a crescent moon-shaped orb, a pink orb, and a blue orb, all, like, over, just over the Oak Creek Canyon Creek. You know, it was dusk. But it's hard to take pictures after that, you know what I mean? The lighting, even with a regular, you know, cell cam phone. You know, they just don't pick it up at night as like they do, you know, they should.
In order to take pictures at night, you need a camera with what's called a B setting. And you...
Okay.
You
push
it on the device you're holding. You know, it's like a long metal thing that you click it open. It opens the shutter, and then you leave it open for a couple of seconds, and it just absorbs the light around it. And
because you know when you take a
you
photo,
pick up
sometimes
of
the moon at night, there's like a streak
camera
coming down from it. You know, like that's what's happening. It's not getting enough light, and something about the shutter isn't working the way it should, right?
Well, like I said, to pick up these things that go around at nighttime that actually leave light trails that are out of the range of our vision, you don't want any flash, you don't want any light. That's why you use a B setting, and you just open up, and whatever is gives off a natural luminous will appear on your photographs. Whereas if you use flash...
Now, what kind of photographs have you
light,
captured? Because you have a book, books about that, right?
That's how I found out about it. I bought a book about night photography, and I just went out there and tried it. Boy, I was surprised. That's what I put in my book, about 75 photograph pictures and enlargements of what I picked up with just a B setting out there in the darkness, no lights whatsoever. And it picks up all these things
great.
And give
you're
off a low candle power light that you can't see with your eyes because it's below the vision of your eyesight.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, yeah, New Mexico, as you know, Roswell is not far from here and all kinds of things. And I've actually captured some really amazing UFO-style vessels or whatever in the sky. And it mainly was at sunrise or sunset, surprisingly. And one time that was during a lightning storm, too, which is kind of cool, and a rainbow coming out. So, and they're different shapes. They're a little different shapes. So, but it's pretty cool, you know, because, and it's so funny, because Roswell's like now competing with Nevada, and everybody's competing with each other. So who's the alien Martian capital of the U.S., I guess?
I was on the computer a couple hours ago, and there was somebody, there's a lot of people representing ETs from other races that are here now, Pleiadians, Arcturians, and stuff like that. This guy's from the Pleiadian cluster of stars, and he apparently had the... a lot of detailed information about the Roswell incident, and he had a different version of the story. He said he certainly was talking, like he knew exactly what went down. He says there was three crafts in a lightning storm from this planet called ZEP or something like that, ZEP, and one of the three crafts got hit by a lightning bolt, and the craft exploded, and the three bodies that fell to the ground, they were all dead, which kind of contradicts that story that one was alive. And then he went on to the details that the other two hightailed it out of there, and these weren't really violent creatures, but they just got caught. They were snooping around a military base, and it just so happens a thunderstorm came and lightning bolt hit one of the crafts, and that's why it crashed.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting. You know, it's so funny. I mean, I believe in all this stuff, but I've never even been to Roswell yet.
Neither have I. Only in the movies I've been there, yeah.
And yeah, they have a TV series they're filming about Roswell. I saw a little bit about that.
The farmer found a piece of metal mm-hmm. that you fold it up and it springs back into its original shape, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of movies and film productions that go on here in New Mexico. Unfortunately, they had that with Alex Baldwin episode with the Western Rust where he accidentally shot somebody, but it had, you know, it was supposed to have blanks in it, and it didn't. So that was really sad, you know?
Yeah, I don't understand. Like, what was he even doing pointing the gun at the cinematographer? Doesn't even make any sense.
No, yeah. It doesn't. No, no.
And nobody
maybe he was
even
just clowning around, but, you know, I don't know. It'll come out.
Yeah, you never point a gun at anybody. They've been clowning around, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I heard that there might have been real bullets in there, possibly. You know,
yeah.
Ballistics.
Why was he pointing the gun at her, you know? It's crazy. And then he shot someone else after that, too. Like, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe he thought they were both blanks, and maybe he just did one, two right after each other. You know what I mean? Like, not knowing, you know, it was going to harm anybody. But I felt really bad about that. Because that is a very rare instance, because I was reading where somebody says it only happens very rarely. And it has to been that nobody was paying attention to the protocol. It has to be, because their protocol is such that no one would have got injured. You know, and there was probably some lackadaisical attitude, because it never happens. So, you know, that's what happened, unfortunately, you know?
Yeah, so much for that. So anyhow, let's get back to saving the world with music, you know? Music can change the world, really. Music can. It's been done before. We could start with Elvis Presley, you know? He became the idol for a generation, and young people wanting to be rebels and dance and have fun. And then It really hit its high mark when the Beatles came around, and they totally changed the whole world. You know, people, it broke all the stereotypes. Men could now grow their hair long, you know. And and they changed the whole music business, too. Now, for a short time there, the artist had everything at his disposal. If you could write songs, man, you were going to get a record contract and they were going to promote you. And it was easy as pie if you had a band together that was good back then. The Beatles opened up the door for all of that. And, it expanded as far as it could into the 70s. And then near the end of the 80s, everything started closing back. The record companies were taking back control, and the variety of music was being stifled. You know, record companies nowadays, basically the big ones, they only want one style, you know.
Right. Well, you know, the United States is very limited compared to other countries, even though we're like one of the biggest music sources. And that's really sad, you know, because so many artists that I know that are living in other countries, they say that you can listen to all kinds of genres of music, all kinds of not the same artists over and over and over again and stuff like that. So, yeah, the record labels have unfortunately done a monopoly where they've, you know, had the same type of singers, the same styles, you know, the same writers, the same producers, you know, all the name people, and they just...
Right,
well,
it's all formula
within
nowadays.
That group sometimes. So so now it's kind of opened up where you really don't need a record label that like you did before. And the other thing is, too, it probably sounded a lot better to have a record deal than it really was to have a record deal. I don't know if you know, but Tom Petty, all kinds of artists, they just got ripped off. I mean, they didn't get monies that were due them. They were working for practically free. And that's what happens when you sign a big-time record label. Not only that, they can even shelf you. But what happens is they end up, charging you expenses for everything that they do, all their promotions and everything. And I've heard stories about even how Sheryl Crow, every time, like, they would give her a contract and they keep increasing it, her expenses were always the same as what her contract was for. For some reason, they always did that. So the only way that major artists really make money is in their concerts. And since they can't perform in their concerts because, pandemic is limited, let's just put it that way, then
yes,
they're not
ma'am.
Making the kind of money that they should be making. And is it worth it to have a major record label deal where you're a prisoner to them and you can't choose your own material or whatever? It's not always as good as it sounds. Let me just put it that way.
Let me tell you, when I went to, in the early 80s, and you could do things like this, I just called up and made myself an appointment. I said, hey, I'm a rock and roll person. I just made some new records. I want an appointment to go see somebody that represents your company. Well, I had the interview the next day. It happened that fast. I went in there. The guy was a total asshole. I played him five different songs to show that, hey, I can write in five different styles. And this was the early 80s already. He was telling me, well, at Atlantic Records here, we only want one style, And this guy was such an asshole. And it was a shock to me that the business had changed so much that record companies weren't interested in people who could write a variety of styles. He admitted a few things. Hey, you got a few good records there, But I walked out of that building that day, and I just said, fuck it. I don't need this shit. Somebody's going to tell me how and what and where to do with my music. And I just didn't even get involved with music for, I don't know, maybe five years at least. I just, forgot about the whole thing because I was having so much fun in life, I'm not going to, jump through hoops for you or anybody else. Oh, okay, I won't make any big money, but, I'm an independent person and you're not going to tell me what I want to do with my music or what kind of songs I want to write. And, my viewpoint on the business that you should have a variety of different styles.
And they do that. They do that everywhere but the United States. They do that in Europe. And people enjoy the music. They just don't make the kind
of
money that we make on music for the way everything is set up or whatever. But, like you said, and we both agree, the money isn't everything, right, about it. So having the creative control, being able to have the say, a lot of big-time artists have gone independent now, and they have their own record labels and such like
that. Well, yeah, because when you sign up with the record label, they want total control of your music and everything else. And if they don't give you the proper promotion, you're shelved and just cataloged, and that's it.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll shelf a good artist or a band anyway because they just decide somebody else just comes along and they think that they have a better shot at doing it, and they'll just drop that person. And they do the same thing in the film business. Like, there was a time when my brother was writing comedies and they were popular, and then all of a sudden it was all just like race cars and crime, and they would be doing all that over in the sex and all that over the comedies, So, there is, things do change, and you got to kind of roll with the times, and you can still write whatever you want to write and hold on to it and submit it later. I mean, it's not going to harm anything, to still continue to do your own thing and just release it when it's appropriate and when it's the right time. Everything comes back. Style comes, fashions come back. Styles of music come back, and again, become infused into something else. I mean, something good, if you got something good, you just keep it and you can change the form of it and modernize it. And people can upgrade their old songs, too. They can change it. They can make it sound more modern, and they can re-release it. you know, and so they probably should, because songs that are 20 years old usually don't have the same exact sound, and they do sound dated. So you do have to always be working on your songs, your catalog. You know, you still got to be looking for the gigs and the promotion. You can't stop, even if it's hard to find. You know, you still got to build up your network, you know.
Well, guess what? We're coming down to the end of the show. Is there anything, any plug you want to give in relation to your Gemstar Records before we end this interesting interview here?
Yeah, I guess I just want to give inspiration to artists right now and songwriters, because I've heard stories about how people were really talented, and then they heard some criticism from someone, and then they decided to stop their music or their dream or their career. Don't let anyone stop you, and don't let the circumstances, don't let the finances, don't let any of that stop you. You want to do it, just please go forward, and, you know, whatever you do that your heart's connected to, you're going to succeed at, you know. So please, please continue and keep the hope and the faith, and you'll succeed. And one way or another, you'll succeed.
That's very good advice for everybody. And I'll say it again. The music can be used to make the world a better place. And so if you're writing a song, you might want to think about putting some lyrics in there that that might be everlasting and might be helpful to guide our human race into a more peaceful, loving place. I mean, take songs like John Lennon's Imagine, you know. He was out there kind of by himself back then, but now we're finally coming around to, yeah, we want that world of peace and love without war and all the crap, you know?
Yeah, and, let's share it. Share the love. Let's share the love,
yes. Yeah, hey. Hey, the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. I mean, the messages were there, you know. And those messages still ring true today.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Tom.
Well, thank you.
Hey, listen, beautifully said.
Kathy, you'll, by the way, today I actually, I was earlier today, I was talking to Liz, and I told her I'm going to send her my book and see what she can do with it. Because after, you know, after the initial publishing of it, the sales went down to nothing. And it's called Connect the Dots Theory. That's where I got the name for the show, Connect the Dots. And it's available at every place there, but without some promotion is what's needed to really get it to sell. And when you, you know, I've mentioned this before on my show. Anybody can Google the first 40 pages of the book for free, because Google does that when they want to, and they just happen to do it for my book, and you'll see the pictures of what I encountered and how I became metaphysical, and you'll see some of the photographs, too, in the first 40 pages, but most of the photographs are after that. And, you know, it gives you... And plus, you see the table of contents page for all the other things. I got 14 chapters in it. And the cover of the book, of course, shows the World Trade Centers and two crystal pyramids. Do you know that? Mm. That's something I discovered by accident. I had two clear crystal pyramids sitting on the window pane. And as I walked by and stood at a certain point, I caught a glimpse of the World Trade Centers. Exact duplicates show up in a light manifestation in two crystal clear pyramids sitting next to each other.
And the implications, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the implications of that are, like, awesome. You know, that's saying that multidimensional energies were used to help bring down the buildings and pulverize the material. I happen to know pyramids, and actually, you don't have to have a physical pyramid to get the active forces of the pyramid going. All you have to do is project 5 points in the air that represent the base and the apex, and the energy will start flowing. And it just so happens when the sunlight was hitting those two pyramids, I couldn't help but notice, man, that looks like the two trade centers sitting there. And I talk about it.
Wow. I'm very observant of you.
Yeah, it was another little discovery in my life, you know. I've had plenty. But that's what I am. I'm a truth seeker. I'm a rock and roller. I'm a video producer. And a joke teller once in a while.
Yeah, you're all around good guy.
Hey, I try. Hey, listen, Kathy Carlson, Kathy C.C. Carlson, president of Gemstar Records. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm going to have to say goodbye now, and you'll see how I end my show. I'm going to call out the engineer and give him the countdown, and then you're going to hear the lead guitar solo at the end of my song, "I Need a Party in Kind." Are you? I don't know. And followed by my anthem, "I Gotta Be Somebody." Both of them are videos are out there on YouTube. Okay.
Wonderful. Can't wait.
What?
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's been a pleasure, Kathy. I'll talk to you during the week or something like that. Okay, Mr. Engineer, let's do this and show Kathy Carlson how it's done. Here's the countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Statistic. I don't want to be just a nobody. Gotta be somebody or I won't be satisfied. Gotta be somebody, feel alive. I don't want to be no John Doe. I don't want to grow just to be old. Gotta be somebody or I won't be satisfied. Gotta be somebody, was here and took my stand without fear, made it clear to the world my ideas. And all those people that had walked on by now stopped and looked, cause I caught their eye. I don't wanna be nobody's slave. I don't wanna join down in my grave. Gotta be somebody or I won't be satisfied. Gotta be somebody. And without fear, it is clear to the world my ideas. And all those people that had walked on by now stop to look, cause I